Hi, everyone, and welcome to the Quilt Fiction Podcast, where our motto is Quilt, Read, Repeat. I'm your host, Frances O'Rourke Dow. For those of you who don't know me, I'm a novelist who writes about quilts, a children's book author, and a quilt journalist. For more about my writing life, you can check out my author website, francesdow.com. We've got three great sponsors for today's episode: Susie Quilts, Fat Quarter Shop, and Denise Schmidt Quilts. Our sponsors have provided some really nice things for this month's giveaway. We are doing two giveaway bundles in March. The first one includes three patterns of your choice from the Susie Quilts Pattern Shop, plus a Hip Hop Hooray layer cake from Fat Quarter Shop. The second giveaway bundle is a year-long membership in Denise Schmidt's Patchwork Panel Club, and this one is big. We're talking a $165 value. Among other things, you'll get four different fabric panels delivered to you throughout 2024. Each panel features nine mix-and-match fabric designs from the DSQ Fabric Archives printed on luxuriously soft, high-density quilting cotton and is over 2 yards of fabric. Links to view each of these great giveaways are in the show notes. To enter, just head over to quiltfiction.com. The entry form is right there on the homepage. In this month's episode, I'm going to be sharing a work in progress with you, a novel I'm writing entitled From the Homefront Diaries of Lorraine Shatterbuck. I seem to be writing a lot in diary form lately. I'm also writing Diary of a Mad Quilter, a contemporary story about an avid quilt maker. Both of these diaries, by the way, are available to read for free on the Quilt Fiction website. You can listen to the audio version of Diary of a Mad Quilter by joining the Quilt Fiction Story Guild for as low as $6 a month. Like Diary of a Mad Quilter, From the Homefront Diaries of Lorraine Shatterbuck is a Milton Falls story, Milton Falls being a town in central Ohio that I made up as the setting for my novels Friendship Album 1933 and Friendship Album Forget Me Not. The diaries begin in 1942, shortly after Lorraine's husband, Jim, has enlisted in the military and has left for basic training. The mother of four, Lorraine has a lot going on during the day, but after the kids go to bed at night, she needs something to fill the empty hours. When her mother suggests that she take up quilt making, Lorraine immediately picks up her needle and thread. What you're hearing here today is the beginning of a story I'm still working on. I am deep into research about World War II and World War II quilts. In fact, after today's audio story, I'll be popping back on to talk about World War II quilts, as well as this month's Book of the Month and Block of the Month. I hope you'll stick around. Okay, here we go. From the Homefront Diaries of Lorraine Shatterbuck. October 5th, 1942. Jim left this morning at 5 o'clock. Only Bobby was up to say goodbye, other than me and the baby, of course. He is taking his new job as man of the house as seriously as only an 8-year-old boy can. He was brave when he told his father goodbye and then burst into tears as soon as Jim was out of view. I made pancakes and then woke up Ann and Janet. The girls were distraught that they hadn't seen Jim off, even though they'd agreed last night it was best to make their farewells at bedtime. The baby, when will we ever call him by his name and not just the baby, is in his playpen as I write. He likes to examine his stuffed animals from all angles and sing them songs in a language no one but he understands. He keeps himself content this way for 20 minutes at a time before he needs a new infusion of excitement. Of all my children, he has proven to be the most self-sufficient at an early age. I'm not sure how I got anything done when Janet was a baby. She wanted to be held all the day long. Mother fussed at me for indulging her, but I couldn't help myself. Janet was just so happy when I held her. Besides, I thought she was going to be our last one, so I wasn't only indulging her, I was indulging myself. And then along came little Paul. You see, he does have a name. Speaking of Mother, she and Dad came to dinner last night. Much to my surprise, Mother brought me a bag of neatly trimmed fabric scraps. I haven't made a quilt in years, haven't had the time, but Mother felt I might like to take up quilting again with Jim away, and I dare say she's right. The children are all in bed by 7:30, though Bobby is angling for an 8 o'clock bedtime these days, now that he's all grown up and in charge. I've never been able to get myself to bed before 10. Nancy Gorman used to snip out quilting patterns from the newspapers. Maybe I'll pop over to see her when I take Paul out for a stroll this afternoon and ask if she has any to lend. Mother never relies on patterns, but I'm not as crafty as she is. If I'm going to make a quilt, I'll need all the help I can get. I hear Paul fussing. Must run. October 20th, 1942. Paul is napping, and I have a minute or two to sneak in a few words before he wakes and it's time to pick up Janet from kindergarten. I've got everything ready to make her lunch as soon as we walk through the door. Even though the children are served graham crackers and milk for a mid-morning snack, Janet is always starving when she gets home. Her teacher, Miss Lovett, is a firm believer that exercise builds healthy bodies and healthy minds. I can testify that it certainly builds a healthy appetite. Instead of writing in my diary, I should be sorting through the box of patterns and notions Nancy Gorman gave me when I stopped by her house on Saturday afternoon. Actually, I had to send Bobby and Anne over to pick the box up and bring it home. It was so full of quilting things that I couldn't manage it and Paul's stroller at the same time. Nancy, it turns out, has given up quilting. She's knitting bandages for the troops instead. When Mother came over after church on Sunday, I told her perhaps I should be knitting bandages instead of amusing myself with quilts. She just laughed in her down-to-earth way and said, "You've done your part for the war by letting Jim sign up to serve instead of waiting for him to be drafted." I suppose she's right, although I'm not sure I let Jim sign up. That would imply that there was any stopping him. Of course, we discussed it, and I have to say the thought of being home with four children while Jim is overseas fighting is a daunting prospect. But he said he couldn't live with himself if he sat the war out and let others bear the burden, and I understand completely. During Mother's visit on Sunday, she and I went through some of the patterns in the box, finally landing on a Nancy Cabot block called Flying Clouds that we both thought was awfully nice. It's a large block, 16 inches, so 5 across and 9 down will make for a fair-sized quilt. I spent some time last night after the children went to bed cutting out pieces for the first block. I hope to start stitching tonight. October 22, 1942. Phyllis stopped by yesterday with some gingerbread and her copy of Eliot Paul's The Last Time I Saw Paris, which she loved and is dying for me to read. It's all about the time the author spent in Paris after the First World War ended and before the Second World War began. Doesn't World War sound awful? It's frightening to contemplate. According to Phil, The Last Time I Saw Paris is an in-depth look at all the different people who lived on Paul's street, and when I'm done reading it, I'll be desperate to move to France. Maybe after the war is over, I told her. Nazi-occupied Paris doesn't sound like much fun. After the war, Phil declared, fist raised. It's her latest motto. She's going to do all sorts of wonderful things after the war is over and Ralph gets back, and her children grow up and leave home, and she can send her horrible dog to live on her brother's farm, and on and on. I'm happy to report that Phil is quite taken by the notion of making quilts. She's always hated sewing dresses and skirts, and, as a result, is terrible at it. But the artist in her is intrigued by quilt making. She thinks we should make a quilting society and invite other women whose husbands are fighting overseas to join us. I don't know. I'm not lacking for a social life. It's solitary pursuits and quiet that I'm in need of. But as Phil points out, my living room is the size of a football field, and though she's exaggerating, it is large as living rooms go and would be perfect for a quilting bee. I've heard that the family that built the house loved having dance parties, and while a ballroom would be ridiculous in a house like this, they thought a spacious living room wouldn't seem out of place. People thought Jim and I were crazy for buying such a big house, but it was priced to sell, and Jim said if we didn't fill it up with children, we'd turn around and sell it when the market was better. Well, fill it up with children we did, and now I couldn't be happier for all the space we have. I feel a bit spoiled, especially when I think of Mother raising 6 children in a 3-bedroom farmhouse. Phil has a long list of women she wants to ask to join us in our quilt making, all of whom live within a 3-block radius. Sometimes it seems like every able man in Milton Falls enlisted after Pearl Harbor. I feel sorry for the ones who were turned away because of infirmity. When Bob Calhoun and Marty Webb came over last week to say goodbye to Jim, they went into great detail about how they'd been the first ones in line at the recruitment office on December 8th. Bob got turned away because he's terribly nearsighted and Marty has a heart murmur. But they both work hard as air wardens and running scrap drives, not to mention that they help all of the families whose husbands and fathers are off to war. I imagine when Christmas comes, they'll be stringing lights on trees up and down Orange Street and beyond. Oh dear, it's almost time to go get Janet. Paul is still sound asleep, and I so hate to wake a sleeping baby, but I suppose I must. October 27th, 1942. I write to Jim every day, and I try to keep my letters cheerful. But in this morning's letter, I had to break the news that Anne sprained her wrist at school yesterday. She was swinging during recess, and that horrible Dilly Glover dared her to jump off. It's not a serious sprain, but Anne is so dramatic that you'd think she'd broken both arms and a leg to boot. Today, Anne and Bobby came home from school excited to make Halloween plans. There will be a party for the children at the elementary school on Saturday night, beginning with a parade through the hallways, and then festivities in the gymnasium, apple bobbing, pin the tail on the witch's cat, that sort of thing. I remember going to school at night as a child for recitals or plays, the strange, spooky feelings it evoked. How different it was from the school I attended during daylight hours. The lights cast strange shadows everywhere, and footsteps echoed loudly down the hall. Even seeing my teachers at night struck an odd chord. They always dressed up for these events, and the younger teachers seemed impossibly beautiful to me, like princesses. Bobby wants to dress up as a tramp for Halloween, which is easy enough. He can wear Jim's old coat that I never got around to mending, and Jim's gardening trousers belted with a piece of rope. I'll blacken a bit of cork to give him the semblance of a beard, and Bob's your uncle, he's good to go. Anne, of course, has more complicated plans. She wants to be the evil queen from the movie Snow White, a movie, I might add, that she's never seen. It's played at the Bijou downtown several times since it first came out, most recently last year, when Anne was 7. Having seen it myself, I felt like Anne would find parts of it too frightening, especially the evil queen. Still, she managed to get hold of the Walt Disney Snow White storybook, which is illustrated with stills from the movie, so she knows exactly how her costume should look. I've told her she should have come up with this marvelous idea earlier. She claims that she did, but we were, quote, all wrapped up and Daddy's going to camp, and she didn't think she ought to mention it. It's a terrible thing to have an intelligent child, especially one so young. In any event, I've got 3 days to put an evil queen costume together, one that looks exactly like the one in the movie that Anne has never seen. Phyllis is going to come over tomorrow morning to help. While she can barely sew a skirt to save her life, she can draw, and she's going to help me sketch a design for a simple black cape with purple lining. Moreover, she claims to be an expert when it comes to making crowns. How wonderful to have an artist for a friend. Maybe she'll have an idea for the sort of sling an evil queen with a sprained wrist would wear. I'm hard at work on my second Flying Clouds block. Mother showed me some helpful shortcuts for putting together the smaller pieces that make up the larger block. It's very scrappy looking, but I don't mind. Besides, it fits in with the times. Which reminds me, I must go and gather things for next week's scrap drive. If I leave it to Bobby, he'll load up all of my pots and pans on his wagon and I'll never see them again. November 15th, 1942. I thought I would write in this diary every day as a way of keeping a detailed record of our daily life to share with Jim when he comes home. But given that I write him letters every day, there's no need to make a duplicate record here. Still, from time to time, I enjoy opening these pages and writing about the things that Jim wouldn't find of much interest, at least not in detail. Of course, I've written to Jim about the quilting group that now meets at my house on Thursday mornings, though I don't go too much into particulars, mostly because I know he'd rather I write about the children. Our quilting group, Phyllis says B is much too old-fashioned, though I rather like it, is small so far, just 6 of us, though 2 of the girls say they know of others who might like to join. I say the more the merrier. After all, the point of the bee is to meet other women whose husbands are fighting in the war, and of course to make quilts, but sometimes that seems like a secondary pursuit, and the real reason we've gathered is to talk and talk and talk. After the first meeting of our quilting bee was over, Phyllis stayed to help finish cleaning up and to gossip. I had to laugh when Phil, in typical Phil fashion, pointed out that our new friends resembled nothing more than the cast of characters from Little Women. It's so true. First, we have Betty Spinner, who's sensible, pretty, and a bit of a social striver, though too nice to actually get very far up the high society ladder. She arrived at the first meeting with her friend, Wilhelmina Billy Paulette, who she fussed at the entire time. Billy, imagine Jo March after she cut her hair for cash, has a broad, friendly face, wears trousers without fail, snaps her gum, and yells, "Damn!" whenever she makes a mistake. Each and every time, Betty seems absolutely shocked, although the two of them have been friends since high school. "Billy!" Betty exclaims when Billy curses. "Language!" Louise Mendelson is a friend of Phil's. They both attend Beth Israel over on Eastern Avenue. Louise is most certainly our Beth, quiet as a mouse, but absolutely delighted by Billy's antics. According to Phyllis, she's also an accomplished pianist, but when I asked her if she would play for us last week, she blushed all the way to her hairline and gave a violent shake of her head. as though the suggestion she might play was absolutely out of the question. Finally, there's Gracie Obenshain, whose real name is Gretchen. She changed it to Gracie when Hitler invaded Paris. She's an accomplished artist and a very talented quilt maker from what I've seen. She's also quite pretty and has yet to pass the mirror in the foyer without getting a glimpse of her reflection and smiling at herself. For all of her vanity, she's truly charming. Her husband, according to Phyllis, is quite wealthy and could have easily avoided serving. But he signed up to do his duty and has been overseas for nearly a year now. Gracie has a 2-year-old who her mother watches, so she can come over to our little group on Thursdays. We have met 3 times now and have had wonderful, lively conversations. Not much quilting has taken place, but we all agreed last week that we will get serious about quilting at our next meeting. We're discussing making quilts to give away, though to whom? Well, we haven't decided that yet. Time to put the potatoes on for dinner. Why does it always feel like it's time to put the potatoes on for dinner? I guess because it always is. November 28, 1942. We celebrated Thanksgiving on Thursday, and I felt Jim's absence in a brand new way. I think up until now, it almost seemed as though Jim's had one of those busy phases at the office. Big project, working all hours and on Saturdays. Our family life is so hectic that it's only when things quiet down at night that I look at the door and think, he's terribly late. And then, of course, I remember. We spent Thanksgiving at Mother's, which was awfully nice. The children were in the big mix of cousins, which took away some of the sting of Jim's not being there. But as we drove home, I couldn't help but think of all those late-night drives home from other Thanksgivings, the children asleep in the back seat, Jim and I whispering about funny things people said or how Uncle Milton had had too much to drink again. Just gossiping, really. And then we'd get home and lug one child at a time up the stairs to their rooms. This time it was me doing all the lugging and all the tucking in. It was terribly lonely, and I was pierced with a sudden fear that Jim wouldn't come back, and we would never have another lovely late-night ride home, and it would always be me tugging off Bobby's shoes and pulling the covers over him, or helping Janet slip into her nightgown while she murmured in some nonsensical dream language. Phyllis called this afternoon to chat about this and that. She wants to go see Casablanca and Columbus as soon as it opens, which probably won't be until January, but that's Phil. She loves having things to look forward to. For reasons that aren't entirely clear to me, she's very upset about the Macy's parade being canceled this year because of the war. Who keeps up with the Macy's parade? Phil, of course. She's always kept up with current affairs, although her news tends to be more about movie stars and the latest fashion trends rather than important events. The hilarious thing is that she has a degree in classical studies from Oberlin. Phil's theory is that Hollywood is our Mount Olympus, and the movie stars are gods of a sort, which is why they fascinate us so. She might be onto something with that. December 2nd, 1942. Everyone I know is devastated by the news of the murder of over 2 million Jews in Europe. Phyllis most of all, of course, but everyone is distraught. There was a vigil last night at Bethel, which Phil reports was well attended. It doesn't change anything, she told me over the phone after she got home, but it was good to light a candle against the darkness. If I had any doubts about Jim enlisting to fight in this war, they have vanished. We must defeat Hitler. December 3rd, 1942. Our quilting bee met this morning. Mother is so kind. As soon as she heard about my little sewing group, she volunteered to come by for Will at 9:30 on Thursday mornings and take him home with her. Dad picked up Janet from kindergarten and took her back to the farm for lunch and then several hours of work as a junior farmhand. Of course, these days the farm is a farm in name only, now that Dad sold off most of the land to a man who plans to build houses on it. How strange that sounds, to have a neighborhood in the middle of nowhere. Dad insists that if Milton Falls continues to grow and attract new businesses, all of the farmland on its perimeters will eventually be eaten up. I do hope he's wrong about that. I understand why Dad and Mom sold off so many acres. It makes sense, since none of us children wanted to take over the farm. But the countryside is so beautiful, I'd hate to see it disappear. Hanukkah begins tonight. It was lovely to hear Phil and Louise talk about their family traditions. When I listen to them, I think how we really do all worship the same God. I asked Phil once her thoughts on Christianity, and she said in her opinion, Jesus had been a terrific guy, and that she wished more Christians would try to act like him. But in a more serious moment, she told me she believed Jesus was a prophet, but not the Messiah, that the Messiah is still to come. That was near the beginning of our friendship. We met at a bookshop in Columbus, both of us searching for a copy of Gone with the Wind, which had sold out at Milton Falls' one tiny bookshop, Pressler & Son Booksellers. Phil and I chatted for 15 minutes before realizing we were from the same town. We immediately made plans to have coffee the following day. I was very pregnant with Janet at the time and was eager to cement our budding friendship before I was overtaken by a new baby. That sounds odd, doesn't it? To cement something that's budding? Like building a sidewalk over a flower garden. I can't remember when we first talked about religion. I was raised in a Congregationalist church, which some people I knew growing up thought was just a loose bunch of freethinkers. I suppose Congregationalists are a pretty independent bunch, though I've been to other churches since and didn't see much of a difference in terms of what the ministers preached. I believe the things most Protestants do, but I've always been fascinated by other religions, particularly Judaism, since there's so much that Christians and Jews have in common. Once I realized that with Phyllis very little was out of bounds conversationally, I asked her about her beliefs, and she asked me about mine, and we've continued to talk about such things ever since. Bobby, Anne, and Janet are somewhat scandalized that Santa Claus doesn't come visit Phil's kids, Mark, Jerry, and Andy, on Christmas Eve. They're also scandalized that Mark, Jerry, and Andy get presents 8 nights in a row during Hanukkah. Last year, Anne mentioned that she might marry a Jewish man so she could have both. That's my practical girl. Our quilting group has a new member, a firebrand of a woman named Pippa McGee. Doesn't that sound like something out of a children's book? Her family is from Alabama, and she has the most marvelous way of saying things. Well, I might could bring some potato salad, she said at our last meeting when we discussed having a light lunch when we next meet, everyone bringing a dish or two. After putting the kids to bed last night, I was worn slap out, was another Pippa-ism from our last meeting. She brought 2 quilts with her, both of them stunning. She called one of them in the rattlesnake pattern. Phil said it looked to her like a pickle dish. The other quilt didn't have a pattern at all. I just made it up as it come to me, was Pippa's explanation. Bobby is having nightmares about a monster coming and stealing Jim away. I don't think you need to be an expert in child psychology to understand what that's about. Anne is beginning to worry about Christmas. For some reason, the idea of Santa Claus coming while Jim is away has become a frightening prospect for her. Jim's parents have invited us to spend Christmas with them in Ashland. That might be for the best. I suppose I should start thinking about what Santa will bring this year, though the thought of Christmas without Jim leaves me feeling like Ebenezer Scrooge, Bah humbug. December 5th. At last, a long letter from Jim. I've gotten nothing but short notes for nearly 2 months. He's been in basic training all this time. I don't know why I thought that once he enlisted, he'd be sent overseas immediately. That's far from the case, as it turns out. Basic training lasts 14 weeks, and that's just the beginning. Jim has reason to believe that he's going to be sent to quartermaster school at Fort Lee, Virginia. As it turns out, being a tax attorney qualifies you to do more than litigate tax cases. He says that he'll more than likely be sent overseas, but at least it won't be as an infantryman. I hope you enjoyed that story, and I want to remind you that I post episodes from the print version, I think those are also known as chapters, on the Quilt Fiction website, so you can keep up with that. I haven't worked on it in a while, but I have spent so much time recently learning about World War II and World War II quilts that I am ready to get back to it. I always have a lot of projects going on, and that's kind of how I like to work, moving around from one thing to another. I do that with quilts, too. In any event, I put Lorraine in a quilting bee with other women whose husbands were serving before I read quilt historian Sue Reich's book on World War II quilts, which is called World War II Quilts. And that is where I learned that, in fact, quilting bees were very popular during World War II. And by the way, this is a fantastic book. So if you have an interest in quilt history, which I very much do, I am pleased to tell you that I recently rejoined the American Quilt Study Group just to get even geekier than I already am. Anyway, it's a great, great book. I've really enjoyed it. And yes, in Reich's book, she has a whole chapter about quilting groups that were formed during World War II. And she quotes an article published on June 3, 1944, in the Northwest Arkansas Times of Fayetteville, Arkansas, which urged women to turn their quilt making into a war weapon. Something to think about right there, ladies. Okay, this is from the article, which is in Sue Reich's book, World War II Quilts, which I recommend. Quilt and comfort making is a very old art, but it took the working ability of the Booger Hollow Home Demonstration Club in Pope County to turn it into a modern warfare weapon, according to Mabel Russell, home demonstration agent. Women of the Booger Hollow community decided after war was declared that they would buy bonds as a club project. Seven $25 bonds at present are owned by the club. Most of the bonds have been bought with money earned by piecing and selling quilts and comforts. Club members buy prints for lining and cotton and thread at an average cost of $1.50 per comfort. The quilts sell from $3.50 to $7.50 each. Meeting in a group at their homes, the women make two comforts in half a day. Okay, I've just got to say that there are a couple of things from this article that just delight me, including the fact that there is a place called Booger Hollow, Arkansas. Now, I looked it up on Wikipedia and learned that the name of the hollow came from a story that there was a road in this community that ran through two cemeteries, and the road was rumored to be haunted. As you probably know, booger has many meanings, but one is a boogeyman or bogeyman. The other thing is, I love the fact that once upon a time in a small community north of Russellville, Arkansas, there was a home demonstration club. Here's an explanation of home demonstration clubs from the Encyclopedia of Arkansas. Home demonstration clubs were an integral part of the U.S. Department of Agriculture Cooperative Extension Service, which was established during the early 20th century as an experiment in adult education, providing agricultural demonstration work for men and home demonstration work for women. The home demonstration work taught farm women improved methods for accomplishing their household responsibilities and encouraged them to better their family's living conditions through home improvements and labor-saving devices. Beyond just the realm of the individual family, the clubs also became sources of education and charity in communities. Now, here in North Carolina, where I am, I know that home demonstration agents started canning clubs and tomato clubs for girls, and it was kind of cool. There are some aspects of the home demonstration agent and that kind of sending teachers to teach rural women that was problematic. That is, I'm already going off subject here with this, so I won't go further into that. But it was an interesting time. I'm pretty sure from my understanding that the home demonstration clubs faded after World War II. But I just love the idea of these women and what was a very small community. I suspect it was attached to a larger community. What did we say, Russellville? And the Booger Hollow was not even in any way incorporated. If you go up into the mountains of North Carolina and other parts of the Appalachian Mountains and the Blue Ridge Mountains, you find these communities that are just, they're just a place within a place. Like, we used to spend a lot of time in Mitchell County, North Carolina, which is up near, it's about an hour from Asheville. And we stayed in a place called Loafer's Glory. And I don't think that was an official address or a township. It was just a place. The way Booger Hollow, was a place where, you know, there were some households, and that the women of this place got together and made quilts to raise money. I think it's just really super cool. So I love that. There's so much about that story I really enjoy. Anyway, let's go back to quilts during World War II, shall we? More specifically, during World War II, women were encouraged to make quilts for all sorts of reasons. Quilts were raffled off and sold to buy war bonds, like with our friends in Booger Hollow, also to make donations to the USO and the Red Cross, and quilts were given to the Red Cross to distribute to wounded soldiers. Women during this time were also encouraged to make quilts as a way of preserving and reserving resources. This is from Reich's book, page 14. Women were encouraged, rather than to buy new clothes, to mend, alter, and accessorize their old clothes and those of their husbands to meet the fashion needs of the time. They were urged to rekindle the American tradition of quilt making to reinforce the clothing they already owned for added warmth. The American Red Cross and women's organizations across the country offered sewing classes to prepare women to adjust to the shortages of available textiles. On September 29, 1942, in Ironwood, Michigan, the Ironwood Daily Globe describes quilting as a new and favorite trend in fashion born out of scarcity and need. The article, entitled "Fashion Favors Quilting," points out that quilting, this is, I'm a quote, "quilting is fashion's favorite this fall, and, patriotically speaking, this fashion has been revived to create warmth without wool for civilian use. Almost any article of clothing takes smartly to quilting, and home sewers are urged to put their Yankee ingenuity to work for the sake of aiding the war effort." I laughed a little bit because I was thinking about those women in Booger Hollow, Arkansas, who probably would not have cared for their efforts being described as Yankee ingenuity, but that's just, you know, me. All right, what kind of quilts were quilters making during that time? Well, all kinds, of course. And we have to remember, even though that article was talking about quilting being rekindled, and this article was published when? 1942. Quilting hadn't really died out all that much. You know, we had a big quilting revival, right, in the 1920s and 30s. And I think that, you know, a lot of women were still quilting. It was really after World War II when quilting went underground, so to speak. And of course, women have always quilted. But as far as being a big national trend, that did die out after World War II. Styles changed, you know, and that's when we started getting into mid-century modern. But in 1942, we weren't that far away from that great quilting revival of the 1920s and 30s. And so some of the quilts that you see in Reich's book are very traditional 1930s style quilts, you know, your grandmother's gardens and that sort of thing. You do see a lot of autograph quilts, which have always been popular or for a long time. I think Reich says beginning during the Civil War, autograph quilts became popular. And in World War II, they were popular again. I think that if I understand correctly, sometimes the autograph quilts were made sort of for people to show their support of the troops. And so it wasn't just quilters who were putting their names onto the quilts, but townspeople. There was also a quilt, a famous quilt, which was called the Famous Name Quilt, where movie stars, including the very popular Mickey Mouse, were asked to sign their names on a white star background. And this quilt was carried around the country and presented at fundraising events. What is to be expected, of course, is that there were lots and lots of patriotic quilts, lots of red, white, and blue quilts, lots of V is for victory quilts, lots of stars and stripes. What's interesting to me is the wide variety of designs. And there were also, by the way, applique quilts. People were doing a lot of interesting patterns and playing around with traditional patterns in a way that strikes me as quite innovative. Now, this brings me, by the way, to the March 2024 Quilt Fiction Block of the Month, which of course is going to be World War II themed. And this month we are going to talk about the Stars of Stripes block. This block is from a quilt pattern published in Aunt Martha's Work Basket that was reprinted in newspapers across the country beginning in 1941. And in the show notes, there's going to be a link to this pattern, the actual pattern that appeared in Aunt Martha's Work Basket. This will be in the show notes. And I have to say, if you're the least bit geeky about this kind of stuff, there will also be in the show notes a link to the Antique Pattern Library, which is where I found the pattern after seeing the quilt in Sue Reich's book. This is such a great resource. It makes me not hate the internet quite so much. Yes, so in the book, you see several pages of variations on the Stars of Stripes pattern. And it's red, white, and blue. It works. There's a reason why we chose it for the United States flag and the French chose it. A lot of people have gone like red, white, and blue. Graphically speaking, graphic design speaking, it's a combination that works. So a lot of these quilts are just super cool. That's my final word on it. No, they're just really innovative, really pleasing to the eye. Now, for fun, I have decided I'm going to make one of those blocks using the pattern as is, which means I have to make templates. It means I'm going to pretend I don't have a rotary cutter and know how to do strip piecing, if that is the correct word, one way to do it, I think the modern quilter, the contemporary quilter, would throw sew red, white, blue strips together and then use it, cut them at a 45 degree angle, which is, if you look at the pattern, you'll see why that would be. But I'm going to use templates. And if I'm going to be really, truly true and accurate and authentic, I will cut those templates out of a cornflakes box. It is very tempting to cut them out of template plastic. We'll see what I end up doing. But I will make a video, which I hope to get posted sometime next week. I'm recording this March 8th, 2024. So look for that, by the way, on our YouTube TV channel, the Quilt Fiction TV channel on YouTube. If you subscribe, it will pop up when it's done. And of course, I think you should subscribe to Quilt Fiction TV, if only for the laughs to be had by watching me doing quilting demonstrations. Okay, Let's talk about the March 2024 Quilt Fiction Book of the Month. When I first started doing research for the Homefront Diaries, I Googled Women on the American Homefront World War II. And as you might imagine, the initial hits were all about Rosie the Riveter types, women who went into the factories to not only take over jobs vacated by men, but also to work on machinery needed for the war. By the height of the war, nearly one in four married women worked outside of the home. And while their stories are fascinating, I was really looking for stories about women like Lorraine, women who stayed at home, planting victory gardens and contributing to scrap collections and that sort of thing. These women have much less representation in accounts of the U.S. home front than working women do. It's a different story if you do the same sort of research for that time period in the UK, even though plenty of women in Britain worked in the munitions factories. Now, at first, only single women did, so that might account for why we get so many reports, so many more reports of women's domestic lives during World War II in the UK. The other reason might simply be that the war impacted daily life in the UK much more so than in the US. The Brits were getting bombed, and beyond Pearl Harbor, the Americans weren't. When I went looking for quilt fiction set in the US during World War II, the pickings were slim. Indeed. There is The Quilter's Apprentice by Jennifer Cheverini, in which Sylvia tells Sarah about growing up during World War II, and there's a book I haven't read called Maybelle and Stitches by Joyce Magnan. If you know of other World War II era novels that include women making quilts, please let me know. Fortunately, when I asked Quilt Fiction Club members, and by the way, the Quilt Fiction Club is Quilt Fiction's Facebook group, and you should join because it is the nicest place to be on Facebook, maybe on the entire internet. Anyway, my dear old friend and a wonderful children's librarian, Chris Kaufman, mentioned Gary Paulsen's children's novel set during World War II, The Quilt. Now, I am a huge Gary Paulsen fan, and if you are looking for a book to get an 11-year-old kid excited about reading, I highly recommend Paulsen's novel Hatchet. But I had never read The Quilt, which is one in a trilogy of books that are based on Paulsen's grandmother. The main character in The Quilt is an unnamed 6-year-old boy, but this is not a sweet and cozy story. Even though the narrator is very young, this is a book for older, more mature readers. I think a thoughtful 6th grader might get a lot from it, and maybe mature 7th and 8th graders even more so. In a way, I think the readers who might get the most from this are adult women. The Quilt is largely autobiographical. Gary Paulsen had a rough childhood. I'm going to read to you from his New York Times obituary. He died in 2021 at the age of 82. When Gary was 4, his mother, Eunice Paulsen, moved with him to Chicago, where she got a job in an ammunition factory. An alcoholic, she would dress Gary in a child-sized soldier's outfit and take him to bars, where she made him sing on tables as a way to get men to pay attention to her. She could also be fiercely protective. Once, he sneaked outside their apartment when she was sleeping. A man dragged him into an alley and began to molest him. Suddenly, his mother appeared, beating and kicking the assailant into unconsciousness. Eventually, her own mother forced her to send Gary to live with an aunt and uncle in northern Minnesota, where he learned to hunt, fish, and live outdoors for long stretches. A year later, though, his mother came to fetch him. His father, now stationed in the Philippines, had decided to stay there, and with the war ending, they were allowed to join him. His family later returned to Minnesota, where his parents drank and fought constantly. To get away from them, Gary would take to the woods, exploring, hunting, and trapping, or wander around their small town, Thief River Falls, near the Canadian border. One day he ducked into a library to get warm. A librarian asked if he had a library card. When he said no, she gave him one, along with a Scripto notebook and a number 2 pencil with instructions to read everything he could and write down everything he thought. "It's hard to talk about it," he said in an interview with NPR in April. "It was a card with my name on it, and God, nobody had given me anything like that." Now I realize I'm going on another tangent by reading this obituary to you, but I think that's so powerful. The power of books, the power of reading and writing in a kid's life, it can change a life, and it changed Gary Paulson's life. Anyway, the quilt takes place during that time that Paulson lived in northern Minnesota when he was a young boy. In the story, he travels with his grandmother to a remote farm where a much older cousin of his is close to giving birth. Her husband is fighting in the war, and she's tending to the farm by herself. Shortly after the boy and his grandmother arrive, the cousin, Christina, goes into labor. With that, the women of the community and the family arrive. The labor is long, and while the women wait, they work on a quilt together. It is a quilt made up of scraps, each one telling a story about a family member's life, and the women tell the boy all the stories that the quilt contains. I found this such a powerful novel. It's really short. It's maybe 80 pages, but it packs an emotional punch. One of the things that the boy realizes during this short time span of the story is how strong women are. And we have to think that these women, okay, first of all, it's very autobiographical, right? This is Gary, this is his grandmother, this is his family, but this family is so different from the family that he has with his parents and the kind of mother he has. And I have to say, this is a book for children, but it's a book you might want to read first by yourself to make sure it's okay for the child in your life. Some kids can deal with stuff, some can't. I think that parents are really good judges of what their kids are ready for. And in this, this six-year-old boy does notice that his he talks about how his mother is often bringing men home. And in fact, when I first read the book, I wondered if she was a prostitute. That is not said, sex is not mentioned, but still, that's there. And at another point, when he and his grandmother go up to Minnesota and then go out to Christina's farm, before she goes into labor, his grandmother and Christina are having a conversation about when she might have gotten pregnant, Christina, and she says something about spending 2 weeks in the sheets when her husband came home on leave. All right, so is a kid going to understand what that means? Maybe, maybe not. But you need to decide whether your kid, you feel good about or okay about your kid reading that. You might, you know your kid better than I do. So I just want to throw that out there. You, on the other hand, should read this book because it is so powerful. And it's a beautiful story, right? It's a beautiful story that takes place during hard times. And it's a beautiful story of a kid who sees another way of life, right? He's coming up from the city into this rural life that he loves. And he sees women who are strong and capable. And I think that's very different from his mother, although she did really kick the heck out of this guy who was trying to molest Paulson. And that is a story that when I first heard it back in the day, the version I heard is that she killed him, but not according to the New York Times, although maybe he died later. Who knows? I don't blame her. I don't hold that against her in the least. Anyway, all right, as you can tell, some of this I'm reading because I'm trying not to go off script. Trying not to ramble. So let me see. Okay. let me go back to this. One of the things the boy realizes during the short time span of the story is how strong women are. These women, Paulson's aunts and great aunts and distant cousins, were farming and taking care of things on their own while their husbands and sons were off at war. And of course, some of these women, the elder women, are widows. He sees women as different from men, but just as capable. Some people like to say that every quilt tells a story. What I say is that every quilt carries a story, and that story has to be told so that it doesn't disappear. This is a novel. The quilt is a novel about one quilt with many stories, stories that are getting passed around and down through the generations. If Paulson were still alive and I could talk to him, I'd ask him if that quilt, because I believe that quilt really existed, does it still exist? Are the stories still told? I'd also like to know if he's ever made a quilt. He certainly appreciated their power. I want to make one more book recommendation to you. This is not quilt related, but we did read it for the March meeting of the Quilt Fiction Club's 1930s book group. It's called Miss Bunkle's Book by D.E. Stevenson. I will do my best to remember to put a link to that in the show notes. So in the 1930s book club, we are reading books that were published in the 1930s, which, as some of you know, my novel, which right now is just only available in an audio form, but I hope this summer it's going to be out in print. Friendship Album 1933 is, of course, set in, that's right, you're with me, 1933. So we started reading these books. I asked people if they would join me as I was working on Friendship Album 1934, which is Forget Me Not is the name of that, if they would join me in reading the books that my characters would have read during this time. And we have a group of about 8 people who meet every month. I think we skipped maybe a couple months in all of that. And we have read some great books. And Miss Bunkle's book, one of my favorites. So funny, set in an English village in the 1930s. It was published in 1934 in the UK, a little later in the States. And it's funny. It's a book about a woman who writes a book about the village that she lives in. And then everyone in the village reads the book. And hilarity ensues. So I highly recommend that book. Okay, that is it for this month's Quilt Fiction Podcast. Guys, you're going to want to tune in to April's episode for sure, because my guest will be the one and only Jennifer Cheverini. That's right. She has a new Elm Creek Quilts book coming out in April, and I'm reading it right now. Don't hate me because I'm beautiful. I'm really, really enjoying it too. So I'm so excited to talk to Jennifer about it, to talk about why she's come back to the Elm Creek Quilters, and just to learn more about her story as I'm reading this one. And it's good. Did I say it's good? Did I tell you I had an advanced review copy? I do. I know. I'm just bragging. But I'm curious about her earlier life as a quilter and what got her started writing. So if you've got a question for Jennifer, get in touch and I'll do my best to get it answered. So anyway, do show up in April. I will see you then. I want to remind you, do not forget to enter the March giveaway. I want to say congratulations to Deanna T. and Melanie J., who are winners of February's giveaway. Thank you so much for entering. If you haven't done so already, be sure to sign up for the Quilt Fiction newsletter. And if you want more quilt fiction in your life, and who doesn't, check out the Story Guild, where you get new quilting audio stories in your inbox every week. Just go to quiltfiction.com to learn more. Thanks again to this month's sponsors, Susie Quilts, Fat Quarter Shop, and Denise Schmidt Quilts. I truly appreciate your support. All right, y'all. I'll see you in April. Can't wait. Bye for now.